Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And today I am incredibly honored and incredibly excited to be here today with Dr. Barry Prezant. Before I introduce Dr. Prezant, I'm going to say, as I always do, that if you have topics that you want to hear, or you yourself want to be interviewed, or you have comments on talks I've done, please reach out to us on health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to get your feedback. So Dr. Prezant was someone that I needed to get a connection to. He is amazing. And here we go with the introduction. First, I'm going to give his contact information so it doesn't get lost in the shuffle. And it will also be in the show notes. He can be found at Barry Prezant, BarryPrizant.com. He also has a website for his CERTS method, educational method called SCERTS.com. He can also be found at the site of his book, uniquelyhuman.com, and also podcast can be found there, and also on major podcast platforms called Uniquely Human. Dr. Prezant, PhD, CCC, SLP, is a recognized among the world's leading authorities on autism and as an innovator of respectful person and family-centered approaches for autistic individuals and those with other neurodevelopmental conditions. He is currently the director of Childhood Communication Services, a private practice, and has 50 years of experience as a scholar, researcher, and international consultant. He has served as an adjunct professor at Brown University for more than 25 years, as an associate professor of psychiatry in the Brown University Medical School, and has held tenured professor appointments at Emerson College, Boston, and Southern Illinois University. He has published 5 books, more than 140 articles and chapters, and is senior author of the CERTS model, a comprehensive educational approach. Now being implemented in more than a dozen countries. Barry has been a 2-time featured presenter, 2013-2017, at the United Nations World Autism Awareness Day in New York City, and has given close to 1,000 presentations at major universities across the US and in more than 25 countries. Over the past 25 years, Barry has also co-developed and co-facilitates a retreat weekend for parents of autistic family members with his wife, Dr. Elaine Meyer of Harvard University. He also has a specific interest on the positive impact of the musical, theatrical, and visual arts for the autistic and disabled children and adults. Barry's recent book, Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism, which was originally published in 2015 and has been republished, edited, and somewhat expanded in 2022, has been the best-selling book on autism since 2015, along with an audiobook version narrated by Barry. It is now published in 24 languages and was ranked by Book Authority as number one of the best 100 books on autism of all time. Barry also co-produces and hosts a podcast, Uniquely Human, the podcast, also found at the Uniquely Human website, with his friend Dave Finch, an autistic audio engineer and New York Times best-selling author. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Prezant. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Oh, I'm just so excited. I really am. I mean, your book is, I think, the best book on autism. I think it's been ranked the best book.
There's a group called Book Authority, mm-hmm. and they use all kinds of metrics. It isn't just the opinion of a bunch of people, but they look at a lot of the ratings online and all kinds of metrics. And 2019, they ranked the first edition as number one of the 100 best books of autism of all time. And that was a surprise. And of course, you know, a lot of gratitude for that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think you really earned that. And I also saw that there was a list of the best autism books written by people with autism, and your book was in it, even though you're not on the spectrum.
Yeah, and that's another great source of pride that my book is recommended by the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and in many cases by people who say you should just read books written by people on the spectrum. And I totally agree with that, that parents and professionals should immerse themselves in those books. But, you know, I guess I'm lucky enough that people saw my book as consistent enough with the values and the experience of people with autism. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really, really amazing. So I want to start out, I have so much to talk about. I don't even, I had such a hard time planning this talk because I have like a 3-hour talk in 1 hour. I don't want to go so shallowly into things. I really want to spend more time on what I think are some of your more unique ideas, and what people I think need to hear more of. But I want to start with the change in your book. You have a new edition out. That's how I found you. I don't understand how I didn't find you earlier, because the original edition is 2015, but now we have our, I think it's 2021.
No, it was April of this year, 2022.
Okay. I don't feel too bad. I took it off the new bookshelf in the library, I guess in April. So there's a specific difference in that book in that you use now autism first language. And I'd like you to start with explaining why you made that change, please.
It's interesting you say autism first language. And a lot of self-advocates have referred to this as identity first language. Mm-hmm. And I made the change for a simple reason. And that is so many people on the spectrum prefer identity first language. And I was initially criticized by some autistic people with the first edition because I used person first language. And one or two of those people said, every autistic person prefers identity first language. And I didn't agree with that because I have a lot of autistic friends and they don't, some don't care. Anyway, yeah. There was some research that did come out. And I guess the estimates are about 65 to 70% of autistic people prefer identity first language. And then a small percentage person first language, and then a larger remainder percentage don't care either way. So no strong opinion.
Right, right. I interviewed Dr. Shore about this, by the way.
Yes.
Who prefers to be called autistic.
Yes.
He gave me those exact numbers. I feel like in a way for people, they might be all confused because like, no, I'm not supposed to say the disability first, right? I mean, but it's identity first, like you said, instead of really disability first. And I think that's the lens that I want to talk about in this talk, which is the whole neurodiversity approach.
Yes. And if I could just mention quickly, many people are now saying that being disabled and having a disability is a part of their identity. Mm-hmm. So Dina Gassner, a wonderful autistic friend of mine who I believe she's now finished her doctorate in social work. She said, no, I am disabled and I want to be able to speak about that, but not necessarily seen as a negative thing. Because what it means is in some areas I need more support.
Right, absolutely. And I also want to talk about your therapy, your model, which is the CERTS model, S-C-E-R-T-S. And I want to talk about the trend in some areas and some autism fields against ABA. I want to do it carefully because I think that there's different ways ABA can be used. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really a very specific way that some people are against ABA.
And it's also not just that there are different ways that ABA could be used. There are different named ABA approaches under that umbrella that in some cases are very different from each other. So it's maybe that's we're saying the same thing, but for example, people will say, oh, I don't do discrete trial training anymore. That's old ABA, yet I see it being done all the time and it's written about now as a strategy to teach. But discrete trial training usually is sitting a child down, doing a number of repetitive trials. It's based upon the antecedent behavior consequence approach. And some people say all of the ABA is based on that. Whereas some forms of ABA now are at least described as primarily play-based and follow the child's lead. So the difference is how much does the teacher or therapist kind of control what's going on as opposed to how much do we give control to the child or the person? Yeah.
Right. And I think that that's a really important way of explaining it. First of all, ABA is applied behavioral analysis for anybody who is listening to this and doesn't know that abbreviation. Can you explain how your model works, the CERTS model?
Our model has, I guess, a number of characteristics that really define the model. And that is CERTS, the acronym, stands for social communication, emotional regulation, and then transactional support, which is a fancy way of saying all of the ways that we support autistic children, adults, and families. So the difference is we identify the highest priorities. And this goes back to our writing. If you look at our writings, we published chapters in the handbooks on autism in the 80s and the 90s. We identify, before we named the model CERTS, we said social communication should be a number one priority. Most people agree with that now. In the past, not so many people agreed that social communication should be. What we contributed that was very novel was, let's not talk about managing behaviors or extinguishing behaviors. Let's talk about helping a person be well-regulated emotionally and physiologically. And of course, that's a huge issue now. It carries over into the issue of mental health, carries over into so many issues, everything from so-called meltdowns to anxiety, so many different areas that is, for some people on the spectrum, those are their major challenges now. So we identified that decades ago, and we spoke very strongly against, this is not just about managing a person's behavior. This is helping a person to be well-regulated and teaching them the strategies that they could use to be well-regulated, which immediately improves quality of life.
Wait, is this model just for kids on the spectrum?
No. And it's funny because, you know, the title of the manual is A Comprehensive Educational Approach for Autistic Children and Now Adults. But the great majority, and the numbers are up around 80 to 90% of children and adults with neurodevelopmental conditions, the great majority have problems with emotional regulation.
Right. And when we're talking about neurodevelopmental issues, it's like 1 in 5 kids nowadays, at least.
Exactly. 20% is the number that is given right now. Yes.
Right. And when you talk about neurodevelopmental disorders, you're talking about those who meet criteria for a dysfunction. It doesn't mean that all the other kids couldn't benefit from emotional regulation.
That's right. Well, and it's not just, and this is another characteristic of the CERTS model. It's a developmental model. It's based upon, I mean, decades and decades of research on child and human development. So there's a handbook about 1,200 pages long, the Handbook on Emotional Regulation, and it has nothing to do with autism. It's about how does every human being develop the capacity to stay well-regulated emotionally, to express emotions, to seek out help when they're feeling distressed, about to go down that spiral into a meltdown, a rage reaction, anger management. So much of that, these are human issues. And so so much of ABA identifies autistic behaviors and, okay, here's the program to deal with that autistic behavior. From the get-go, the CERTS model was about, let's look at every autistic person as an evolving human being. Mm. Let's fold in what we know about how all people develop. Let's identify how it may be different in some ways for autistic people, and let's put in the right supports to help people communicate better, regulate physiologically and emotionally better, seek out help, develop relationships, and essentially have a better quality of life, whether it's in employment, in school. I know a point you want to talk about, friendships. Mm-hmm. All of these issues are huge.
Right. I mean, I think when you talk about social communication, that's the essence of autism, really. It is a social communication disorder, right? So that would be more specific to people on the spectrum. But the emotional regulation, I mean, I'm seeing more and more a shift away from behavioral approaches and more to co-regulation, emotional regulation, attachment models.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's been much more of an infusion of, you know, you mentioned co-regulation. That's a term that's very similar to a term we use, which is mutual regulation. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with regulating with another person, the influence of another person to help you regulate. And again, I always like, I talk about this in my book, Uniquely Human, but when I give workshops, presentations, I always like to give tons of examples of how that pertains to every person.
Right.
I think people who are kind of have the best quality of life have that good combination of knowing what to do to help themselves, self-regulation, and knowing how to seek out and accept help from others when needed. And that's the mutual regulation and co-regulation piece.
Right. So who uses this program?
Oh, it's used in many places. It's used in more than a dozen countries right now. Mm-hmm. The manuals are translated into Italian, into Korean, a big following in Japan. In the United States, it depends upon the school district or the clinic. I consult to autism-specific schools that use the CERTS model. Sometimes the CERTS model is used with other approaches, very often other developmental approaches. So ABA has been around since the 60s and 70s. It used to be called behavior modification. Mm-hmm. And they've developed, to a fault, they've developed incredibly prolific business models. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I think you wanted to talk about is why a lot of autistic people have concerns about ABA. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that ABA became so popular so quickly, I'll just say it, is misinformation. For decades, and still now, you have applied behavior analysts saying it's the only evidence-based approach, meaning the only approach that has research that supports it being effective. And that's not true at all.
It's the gold standard.
Exactly. And if you look at the most neutral, unbiased reviews of all of the treatment approaches, even to this day, it's say there's no evidence that any one approach is better than any others. And can we talk about one approach for all autistic people? And most people are saying, no, it's not the case. What we believe we did with the CERTS model is we identified universal aspects of child and human development that's important for all people, but people on the spectrum are particularly challenged in the social communication and the emotional regulation area.
Right, but when we talk about applied behavioral analysis, the way I understand it is that kids on the spectrum often have trouble learning a specific skill because it has many components. Mm-hmm. So that ABA can break them down.
Yeah. And some people will say, well, that's what ABA is you break down skills into small components and you teach those components in a particular sequence. And when you put the pieces together, the child has the skill. I mean, that's a good that's a teaching strategy that's been around for centuries. You know, ABA does not own that, okay? Parents who've never heard about ABA teach their kids to tie their shoes that way. And ABA says, well, yeah, that's one of the strengths. And if it's done well, it could be one of the strengths, but it's not just an ABA strategy. Mm. The ABA strategy really is looking at kind of environmental determinants of how a child learns and is trained to learn skills, okay? So applied behavior analysis, you analyze the behavioral aspects of a skill, and then you need to go ahead and train it. Again, that gets into a murky area when applied behavior analysts say, well, we don't do that in such a strict, rigid, inflexible way anymore. We play with kids. We follow their lead. We choose what they prefer to do. That was the definition of good developmental approaches for the last 60 years. Mm-hmm. Without getting into any more of the weeds on this, mm-hmm. a lot of what people say is the new ABA or the ABA that, has changed from the old control of the child, and especially the old, train the stims out of the child and all of that. In my opinion, the new ABA is what it is because they've infused a lot more developmental and child-centered information into what they do.
Right. Do you use anything from ABA in your model?
That's an interesting question. Again, an applied behavior analyst could look at some things that we've done and say, oh, that's just ABA. And we would say, no, that does not come out of the research and the literature on applied behavior analysis. That comes out of the developmental literature. The model that most has influenced the CERTS model is called the transactional model of child and human development. When I was in the medical school at Brown, the research director of the hospital I was at, world famous, he's retired now, world famous developmental psychologist named Arnold Samaroff, he developed the transactional model of child development in the 70s. And basically what it says is that both partners play a role in the child learning, that we have to be highly responsive to kids. We have to read their signals. If a child, is upset or dysregulated emotionally, we have to recognize that. We have to change what we do. So one of my favorite quotes from my friend Michael John Carley, who's on the spectrum, and you've read about it in Uniquely Human, is the best way to help an autistic person is to change what we do, not to try to get in there and change the behavior of the person directly. Let's change our relationship. Let's change how we support that person. Let's develop trust with that person. Because kids and all people learn the best in a trusting relationship where people are sensitive to who we are as human beings. ABA is not about that. ABA is writing the program, following the steps in the program, in many cases using that same program for every kid who walks through the door, and without the flexibility to adjust what we do for who that child is. Now, some ABA people will say, well, we do that now. And I would say, yeah, but that's not what ABA was originally.
Is there evidence for your model?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Number of studies, as a matter of fact, fairly large sample studies. There's, and this is all peer-reviewed published studies. One study that came out just about 5-6 years ago looked at I believe it was about 160 kids in 120 classrooms. It was called CERTS Classroom-Based Intervention, okay? Around the country that was done. The first author is Lindy Morgan, who is kind of, she's not a CERTS co-author, but she's collaborated with some of the CERTS collaborators. Amy Weatherby and Kathy Lord, a number of years ago, and they're still following up, followed studies from early identification of over 80 kids. So we have published research, and that was published in Pediatrics in one of the most difficult journals to get published in.
Wow. I read something from Hong Kong where they had 120 plus kids.
Yes, yeah, and we do have a number of studies that are international studies. Mm-hmm. Model, yes.
I'm going to be a little difficult here. Why aren't we using this more? I have not seen it used. Why is ABA so universal and not this model?
Once again, as far as, there are many answers to that. The first answer is ABA has been around for 30 years longer. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's number one. Okay. Number two is, and here we get into the ethics of treatment and discussion of the effectiveness of approaches. For decades, applied behavior analysts are saying we have the only thing that works, which is not true, okay? And how do you define works? all right, so that's a huge issue. And they've been called on that. I mean, I've done it in presentations for the Autism Society of America. There's some recent research that indicates that when looking, and it's called meta-analysis, meaning you look at a whole bunch of studies, that developmental approaches are now seen as more effective for the research on developmental approaches. But the research came later on developmental approaches, okay? The other thing is the business model. And there's a lot of pushback against that now. There's venture capital money that's put behind ABA clinics, which often recommends 30 to 40 hours of therapy, and there's no evidence that that's needed. As a matter of fact, the evidence is 20 to 25 hours of engagement in learning activities that focus on social communication and that teach skills that fit into a child's life. That's another criticism of ABA. Even to this day, very often skills are taught that are not necessarily functional for a child in everyday life.
Not generalizable, right.
I'm not saying all
right.
ABA approaches do this. So there's real pushback now against, you know, these big venture capital supported ABA clinics. One reason, by the way, is terrible training of the so-called registered behavioral therapists. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, the higher level, which is the board certified behavior analyst, the BCBA, no training in child and human development. Mm-hmm. How could you work with children mm-hmm. when the training you get to do ABA has no training in child and human development? What they're trained in is behavior change. How do you change behaviors? The problem with that is, if you don't understand a child from a developmental perspective, not only could you be missing the mark, but you could actually be harming the child.
But see, but yeah, that I see it also as we have a strong drive now to try to get kids to meet academic criteria that's not really developmentally appropriate.
Right.
And so ABA fits into that model, right? Let's teach them those skills as fast as we can, even if they're not really ready or it's not really appropriate.
I mean, it gets
everybody should be doing the same academic goals, yeah, no matter what their disability.
It gets back to how you even define learning, okay? Mm. And we know very often autistic people, due to having strong rote memories, when things are taught in a very, very specific regimented way, if you have the right quote unquote stimulus, the child will respond with the answers that the child was trained to respond with, okay? So some skills can be taught that way. Social communication skills can't. Emotional regulation abilities can't, okay? So it's how you define learning. And unfortunately for years, a lot of people in ABA programs would collect the data, demonstrate on their data chart, well, the child can answer this question, this question, this question. And then the family and maybe people who know the child outside of the school say, but he never uses that. Well, she never uses that. It's not an integrated part of their knowledge. It's almost like a trick that's learned. So when I show you a picture of a man wearing a red shirt sitting on a horse, I could train a child to say, the man in the red shirt is sitting on the horse. Good boy. Good job. On to the next. I know kids who communicate spontaneously better in 1 to 2 word utterances than they do in 8 word sentences that they were trained in ABA sessions.
Wow. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wow.
And in ABA, it's called generalization problems. It's not generalization problems. It's that the child has never connected the dots of what they're learning as meaningful information in their lives. One of the questions that you had, and that is, why is this controversy and why are some autistic people against it?
Right.
So what you hear from autistic people the most, and you hear this on our podcast in so many mm-hmm. of the episodes, because the great majority of the episodes are interviews with autistic people, right, that, and this comes out so much. I mean, it teaches masking. Okay, that ABA teaches autistic kids to look normal, which may include discouraging natural ways to communicate. What do I mean by that? As you know, a lot of autistic people do not make, and I hate the term, but I'll use it, do not make eye contact to the same extent that other people do. So eye contact training, you know, goes way back in ABA. Some ABA people say, well, we don't do that anymore. Well, we don't do it to the same extent. All right, so that's the shift away. Why do we not do it to the same extent? Because autistic people are telling us in many cases, it can be stressful and difficult for them to have coerced look at me. They can't process the language as well, okay? Another way that masking is taught, if a child needs to stim or to rock, or to pace, to regulate, very often ABA programs are designed to stop that, okay? Let me say something that it's kind of a heavy subject, but we had what I thought was an incredible interview yesterday for our podcast. This podcast is not out yet. Lisa Morgan, who's on the spectrum, she's an expert in suicide issues. Mm. And right now the numbers are difficult to hear, but autistic people are 7 to 9 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population. When I asked her, what is one of the primary reasons that people on the spectrum may attempt suicide? And she said, because for decades or years and years and years, people have taught them to mask and not be their normal selves, not allow them to be autistic.
This is bringing me to a really important point, which is why the diagnosis is important, but also there's a tension between the parents who just want their children to be normal. And that's a whole separate thing to unpack, what is normal, because really when you dig down, we want our children to be happy. We want them to function. We want them to have full lives, but sometimes that becomes what we think normal is. And I love your line from the book, autism isn't an illness, it's a different way of being human.
Yes, yeah. And, yeah, that's what autistic people are saying. Right. You know, the classic line from Temple Grandin a number of years ago, mm-hmm. You know, I'm not less, I'm different, okay? And one thing that I've kind of embraced because part of my training is in cultural differences in communication, cultural differences in child rearing. Lisa Morgan brought this up yesterday in our podcast recording, which, by the way, plug here, will be out on September 30th because this is, in general, this is Suicide Prevention Month. But it's just a really, really tough issue. But what Lisa says is one of the best ways to prevent suicide or attempts at suicide is to allow autistic people to be their authentic selves. Now, that doesn't mean that if an autistic person is doing something that's harmful to self or harmful to others, or maybe kind of going off the rails a little bit, that doesn't mean we guide the person, we don't guide the person and support the person. We do that with all people. We do that with typically developing kids. It's called kind of guided support, guided participation. That's very different than, you know, you're a bad kid because you need to pace when you're feeling anxious. Stop that autistic behavior. Look at me. You have to look at me. So much of what autistic people say is how much for so many years they were told they were getting it wrong, that they were being rude when they were being honest, okay? That they were being avoidant when they were refusing to do something that was just too difficult for them to do or even traumatizing for them to do. So many attributions were placed on what we see in autistic people that has led to low self-esteem, lack of development of a sense of self, a sense of agency. I am a person, I have opinions. And now you might say, and some of your listeners might be saying, well, what about the more challenged people? What about people with fewer communication skills or who communicate at earlier levels? All of what I'm talking about can pertain to them as well, to people who need higher levels of support, as opposed to people who get along with lower levels of support. And I like the way I prefer to use those terms, and we've used it for a few decades now, rather than, you know, I wrote an article 12 years ago about why we shouldn't use high functioning and low functioning.
Absolutely.
And people say, well, what's the alternative? Let's talk about support levels. People who need more levels of support in certain activities versus people who get along well with lower levels of support. And I think that's not only is it much more respectful, but it's also, you know, much more practical. Okay, how much support is needed for, you know, a young man to get on the bus, whatever, to go to music lessons? How much support is needed for this student to even know where the cafeteria is in the school? So I think that that's a much better way of looking at it. Another important point, and I can go on and on, but I'll make one more point as to why autistic people, you know, for quite a while have had concerns about ABA. And that is applied behavior analysis has never really incorporated autistic voices and autistic perspectives. As a matter of fact, I could give you extreme examples. where very, very prominent people on the spectrum would speak up about against ABA, and ABA leaders would say, oh, that person's really not autistic. You know, that person is a fraud. That happened to Donna Williams from Australia a number of years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
As she was touring in the United States, one of the first people to talk about her concerns about ABA, who was autistic, and a lot of ABA agencies were saying, don't listen to her. She's a fraud. She's not autistic. So, yeah, that's a big, big issue.
I mean, it feels like from what you're saying that there's a fight between the mainstream world trying to fix autistic people and autistic advocates saying, don't fix me, I'm not broken.
Yes, yeah. And that gets to a term that I think we first used this term a few years ago. Now it's become very popular. And that is, let's not pathologize autistic people and what they do. Okay, let's look at it as human behavior. Okay, but it's not, oh, you know, well, he does that, he rocks because he's autistic and we have to stop it because the way to treat autism is to get rid of autistic behaviors. Okay, that goes back to my dissertation research on echolalia or repetition of speech. It was pathologized by the founder of ABA, Lovaas. From a developmental perspective, not only did I hypothesize that it may be a different way to learn to communicate, but I then did a study, a videotape analysis of four kids over a year, and was able to prove that echolalia was their way to communicate. Now, some people get
stories. I mean, to interrupt you, I want you to share a couple of the stories because I think those stories make it so clear. It was one of my favorite parts of the book.
Oh, yeah. And the book has tons of stories.
Yeah.
But, you know, one story that you probably remember is a young girl in a classroom I was consulting to, and I came into the classroom and she looked at me and she said, got a splinter. And I looked at the teacher and the teacher said, Chloe, don't worry. Barry's a nice man. It's okay. Barry's just visiting us today. And she looked at me and she went, got a splinter. And then the teacher said again, Barry's a nice man. He's okay. And I'm wondering why she's saying that. Okay. And then Chloe echoed, Barry's a nice man. Barry's a nice man. Hello, Barry. Barry's a nice man. And the teacher explained to me that, and this was what would be called delayed echolalia or scripting, mm-hmm. that the year before she had gotten a bad splinter out on the playground, was in pain, feeling very anxious. She used that phrase whenever she felt anxiety or fear. So it was her way of communicating that. And my recommendation was, well, let's teach Chloe that got a splinter means I'm anxious or I need help or I'm scared, to help her kind of, if you will, mediate into the neurotypical world way of saying that, not saying stop the silly talk. That mm-hmm. would be the ABA way of dealing with it. Okay.
But that's an example of her communicating. It was not pointless. I'm just wondering also if she was thinking, hey, you're Dr. Prezant, are you a doctor that takes splinters out?
But she didn't have a splinter at this time. Yeah.
But if she heard you introduced as Dr. Prezant, maybe she was thinking, hey, this is a doctor and doctors do things that hurt.
Right. Well, I mean, I've run into that as well. When I was introduced to two stories, I was in a preschool, this absolutely precious little four-year-old autistic boy. And the teacher said, this is Dr. Barry. And he laid down on the ground and said, give me a checkup.
I love it.
And another story, which is not kind of as nice as that one, is I was visiting a child at home and he was a little bit nervous. So he was in his bedroom and his father said, okay, Mark, come on out. Dr. Barry's here. And he said, no needles. And then his dad said, no, Dr. Barry's a play doctor. He's not a needle doctor. So sometimes you have those associations. But let me just a quick example, because that was an example of delayed echolalia or scripting. Sometimes we say to a child, you know, are you hungry? Do you want a cookie? And the child goes, want a cookie. That's saying yes through echolalia. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now get this. Leo Kanner, in his first article in 1943, he wrote a lot about echolalia. And he called that affirmation by repetition. He actually said, if a child repeats what you say, very often it means yes. Okay, want to go out? Want to go out? All right. In come the behaviorists, and they call all echolalia meaningless parroting and psychotic speech. Mm. It's pathologizing even what Kanner, kind of the, one of the people to first describe autism, Kanner even recognized it as communicative in some instances. So much of what goes on and has gone on in the history of ABA is looking at behaviors, saying it's autistic, it's psychotic, it's wrong, it needs to be extinguished. And now you hear many adults who had gone through that saying how traumatic it was for them.
Mm. So what would you say to parents of a newly diagnosed child? I have two parts to this question. And then how can we help all the healthcare people and educators change and make a paradigm shift?
Yeah, well, I'll just say this with pride. Our book, Uniquely Human, is making a big step in that direction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me give you an example.
Everyone should read it. Sorry.
I mean, if you look at the close to 3,000 ratings, but 500-600 comments on the Amazon page for the book.
I think 4,000, but yeah. Uh-huh.
So many parents who put comments in say, you gave me a different lens to look at my child. So many parents say, it's not just about behaviors. That's what I was taught. Okay. It's about understanding my child's experience and understanding how he or she sees the world. And then folding that into the way I support my child. I want to understand my child's perspective. If you're not on the spectrum, if you're neurotypical like I am, we're guessing. If you're on the spectrum, you could provide some insight into parents. That's another big thing. That, number one, parents need to listen to autistic people. Absolutely. And I think you know, and I'll say this for people who have not read Uniquely Human yet, it's full of autistic voices. Right. You know, on and on and on. Now, I will say this, again, another source of pride. A lot of my hypotheses, because I was trained in child and human development, that I wrote about even years before Temple Grandin spoke out as an autistic person were in the ballpark, were right.
Right.
And that's why I think our work has been embraced by the autistic community. Because so many autistic people say, you know, I know you're not on the spectrum, but you kind of have a way of understanding how we see the world. Okay.
You're an it person.
Yeah.
That was another favorite part of the book. We're not going to get into that. They have to read the book to find out what I mean by that.
Yeah. And by the way, I should, another little plug here. If you're not a reader, this wasn't the case for the first edition, but it is the case for the second edition. Mm-hmm. I narrate the audiobook. And so you will hear me telling stories about families and kids that not only have I known, but in many cases I've known for decades. I've had the privilege of being on the journey. I've lived in the same area for 35 years. Parents I see now who have kids late 20s into their early 30s, I knew them and their kids when they were preschoolers.
Right. It's an incredible perspective. And this is such an honor, I'm telling you, to interview you. And again, people can also listen to all the different podcast episodes you did. I'm giving you all these plugs. I get no money for this, people should know. I don't get paid. You didn't pay me. But I think it's so important to get the word out, not just to parents, but also to all the healthcare professionals, educators, et cetera. You didn't answer that part of my question yet.
Yeah. Oh, well, let me just
make a paradigm shift.
Let me share a story with you. And this was terribly exciting to me. I'm not going to name names, but a person who is the director of emergency medicine, I believe, in a large hospital, actually Phoenix Children's Hospital. She contacted me, I would say about 4 months ago, and said that so many people in the emergency department and emergency rooms, of course, are seeing a lot of autistic people and autistic children coming in. Well, this is a children's hospital. Mm-hmm. And she said, I want every member of the staff, I want the social workers, I want the nurses, I want the emergency physicians to read your book. because they need to understand reactions of autistic people. So right now, 20 or 30 of her staff, as we speak, they've just gotten multiple copies of the book, and they're going to be doing, from what I understand, will be a reading group for all of the staff in this hospital in the emergency department to read my book to give them more insight on how to best support autistic people.
That is amazing. You know, I brought in an autism expert into my pediatric practice a couple of years ago.
Wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. And you interviewed the inimitable Mel Hauser.
Mel is fantastic. Family practitioner, pediatrician, yeah, on the spectrum,
right,
who's doing things very differently in providing services than traditional ways of doing it. Yes.
So my practice, she's actually, her mother is on staff at Ally, which is a pediatric supergroup I'm part of, and they brought her in to talk to all the Ally pediatricians.
Wonderful.
It was amazing. But I have to say that one talk alone is not going to do it. It really is a paradigm shift. I keep using that word, because I've spoken to some people who listened to her and didn't quite like fully, you know, understand. It's hard to shift the way you think when you're reading. ABA is gold standard. And then you're right. Hearing you talk about all the concerns about it. And these are the people who are recommending it to brand new parents.
Well, I absolutely love Mel's phrase when she said, I went to medical school, you know, I'm a physician. I graduated medical school. I did my residency. And she said, and then I needed to unlearn so much of what I learned.
Right.
And it is, it's very, you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to unlearn what you've been indoctrinated into learning. So very, and it's kind of interesting for me because my son is in his second year of medical school now, but he knows a hell of a lot about autism.
Yeah.
He's at a major school. He's at Duke University, where they have a very large autism clinic there. And so he just, I guess they just had a couple of lectures on autism. And he said, actually, it was pretty good. It was very respectful. It was really considering and talking about the impact that autistic people are now having on services. But you're right, there's a long way to go. But there are also people like Mel, Anita Lesko, mm-hmm, who is a nurse anesthetist. She wrote a book about, you know, the right way to support autistic people in healthcare settings. But we're just at the beginning of that.
Right. It's also hard, though. Right. I mean, it's hard. It often takes resources that not everybody has.
Yes.
I also want to talk more about neurodiversity, because we mentioned it at the beginning and we didn't really explain. I think there's a neurodiversity lens as opposed to a pathology lens. And
yes,
this is what I wish healthcare professionals, educators could get.
Yes.
Talk a little bit more about what I mean by that.
Yeah. And I'm going to quote the name of Mel's group that she's formed. It's called All Brains Belong. I love it.
All Brains are awesome from her.
Yeah. and what a neurodiversity lens appreciates is that every person is wired differently. Every person therefore perceives the world differently, experiences emotions differently, experiences sensations differently, is good at some things, not so good at other things. So it's kind of anti-pathologizing, because we've looked at people good at some things and not so good at other things, and we've said that person is deficient, or we label it a disorder. Now, I'm not talking about serious medical illnesses here, okay?
Yeah, or serious behavior problems, which we, yeah.
Yeah, but even people who are, for example, highly anxious, okay? Or people who have bipolar and may have serious kind of problem behaviors because of that. You know, there we're talking about, in some cases, medication may be helpful because the source is a neurochemical source, or maybe a source of seizures might be the source of behavior that's just harmful to self, harmful to others. What we're talking about is literally every person, you and I, have kind of a profile of things we're very good at, things we're okay at, things we're lousy at, we'll never be good at, okay? And we need to make changes in work settings, in society, to accommodate for people's differences so that everybody could have a good quality of life and be successful. So let me give an example of my wife. My wife does not, she's not on the spectrum. She does not have an identified quote unquote disability, but she can't look at a map and make sense of it. I mean, she really can't. So, you know, before we had GPS, she would not want to drive by looking at a map and trying to figure out how to get there, okay? There are certain things she knows she's not good at all. So I don't know if there's an equivalent to like dyslexia for not being able to read a map. But, you know, the point is that I had to accommodate for her. And there are other things I need to accommodate now. Now that I'm getting older and my wife of 35 years is getting older, you know, we have to be executive function supports for each other. What does that mean? You know, we'll say, walk into the house. Okay, there are three things we really need to take care of or two people we need to call. Oh, damn it, I remember the first person, but who was the second person that we needed to get in touch with? And I will say, oh, I think it was this person. We need to accommodate. People accommodate for each other, okay? And we have to have society accommodate as well. And that's happening. Just a quick story.
Because that's where I see the tension, right? That parents are like, the world's not going to accommodate my kid. I've got to fix my kid.
I disagree with that.
But it's a natural fear.
Absolutely. It's much slower than we wish. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the classic example is more sensory friendly shows. Mm-hmm. So that people, and the word is access, and Mel used that word a lot. Mm-hmm. So people have access to whatever is out there, whether it's in healthcare. And that's what Mel is doing. You know, she's creating a practice that doesn't create fear and anxiety for people going to see the doctor. Okay. So it's allowing for greater access. I was just at a museum of all places in Boise, Idaho. I was giving a talk at a conference there, and I went, I had some free time. And so my wife and I went to the Boise Art Museum, and you walk in and they have this big picture and it says, ask us for our sensory packet. And they will give, and they got funding for it. They will give you a big plastic packet if you wish to take it that has fidgets, that has, a little very clear map, much, much more clear than the map that everybody gets of the museum and the different rooms, that identifies where the audio stations are. If you can't read and you just want to have somebody tell you about the exhibit. So it's happening more and more. Another quick example, in New York State, Letchworth State Park, a group got some major grants. And they created what they call autism nature trails. It's very visually mediated. Some of the steps have been changed if they were a little tricky for people with movement issues and coordination issues. And one of my colleagues on the CERTS model, Amy Laurent, who's a psychologist and an OT, she consulted to the project. So it's based upon the CERTS model. So what I'm saying is things are happening and changing, but much too slowly. What needs to change is the attitude of people in the public to be able to look at a person behaving differently and not necessarily jump to the pathologizing attribution or interpretation of what that person is and why they're doing that.
Right. And I think for parents of a child on the spectrum, I think it's a balancing act between trying to help your child function as best they can in a world that is the way it is right now.
Yes.
Advocating for your child's access needs, for what they actually need right now.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that, and I mean, of course, I am not saying that, yes, parents, you're right, we should just fix your child. What I am saying, some of my closest autistic friends say this as well, it's not that the whole world has to become autism friendly overnight or built upon the way an autistic person sees the world, okay? That there is that middle ground, okay? So my friend Michael John Carley says this. Let me give you a contrasting example. We interviewed, I'm having a moment here because it was like a year and a half ago. She's wonderful, from Australia, autistic woman who has three autistic kids and an autistic husband. Mm-hmm. And she basically said, you know, we've given up on the neurotypical world. They don't get us. We create our own autism bubble, and that's the way we need to lead our lives. And when I speak to my friends, Michael and even Dave Finch, my co-host on the podcast, they go, no, autistic people need to learn when it's going to improve their quality of life. They need to learn neurotypical rules and neurotypical ways. They may not agree with all of them, but they need to be aware of them so they could understand, you know, why a person gets upset if an autistic person just talks about what they want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there is, and this is an ongoing discussion, you're absolutely right. There needs to be that continuing discussion of continuing to change the world to be more autism sensitive and more autism friendly. But people on the spectrum, to the extent of their abilities, need to be more aware of neurotypical ways. And again, we've had so many, Carly Ott, an autistic woman who's a bank vice president. We interviewed her on a podcast, and she said, after she got a late diagnosis of autism, she learned neurotypical ways, that she would practice in the shower the way to greet people, okay? She would practice in the shower the way to end a conversation rather than just walking away in the middle of a conversation. So, you know, maybe that's the wrong phrase, but the jury's kind of out. Some autistic people are saying, no, you know, we are a separate culture, and the neurotypical world needs to learn the ways of our culture, and we should be the way we want to be. And then even many autistic people are saying, there is that middle ground.
Mm.
But the caveat is, learning neurotypical rules and ways, if it improves quality of life and access, not doing it just to do it and mask just to do it.
Right. I mean, I think the underlying issue is, are you doing this because your autism is bad and you want to fake normal, or are you meeting the societal expectations? But you are who you are and you're proud of who you are. At the end of the day, though, from the parent's perspective, right? I mean, from a parent of a child who's newly diagnosed perspective, right? They want that child to function in today's world, right?
Yes.
I mean, it might be different for, say, a parent who's autistic and proud of being autistic. And I know you've interviewed, it was a terrific interview between an autistic mom and a mom of a kid on the spectrum who was, I think, neurotypical, who came out with a book that's coming out in January, I Will Die on This Hill.
Well, we interviewed them also.
You did. No, I'm saying I listened to that interview.
On our podcast, yes. Yeah, Jules Edward and Megan Ashburn, yes.
But I think what's important there is to, no matter what perspective you have, it should always be, I love my child, I accept them for who they are. It sounds so basic, and that's why the pathologizing approach is so dangerous.
Yes, and we always have to go back to, what's the impact on the child? And that's why, you know, I like to use the term kind of guidance as opposed to fixing, you know. And again, that's something we do with any kids. You know, if a so-called neurotypical child, you know, is doing something that may be harmful to another child, gets upset and hits them. Okay. We don't say, you're a bad kid, you hit that child. We might say, you know, you might have hurt Timmy there, you know. And if you're angry, you could say, Timmy, no, don't take that. You know, what we do is we guide. We don't come down on them. But for so many years, with throwing kids into timeout, you know, and taking reinforcers away, response cost, it's called in ABA, we're giving the message to a child who already has problems interpreting the social signals of the neurotypical world. We're giving them messages that they're just a bad human being.
And that's terrible. And this is, by the way, applicable to all kids.
Absolutely.
This is not just for kids on the spectrum. And that's why I said before that there is a movement away from the strict behavioral approach for good reason.
Yes. And there's a movement away from the strict behavioral approach, even within behavioral approaches. So it's interesting. But no, things, there's no doubt about it. Things are changing, not changing fast enough. All right. And, you know, the other huge difference that has happened, in my opinion, other than having all these autistic voices for us to learn from, is strength-based approaches.
Mm.
Is really understanding that if a person loves something, loves doing something, is very good at something, or could be very good at something, shows a special interest, let's build that into our school programs. Let's build that into that child's life, for the simple reason that if you're spending more time doing things you love, you're going to be happier.
Right, right.
And you're going to develop more trust with other people.
Right. And it's so basic. I mean, you're coming at it from a child-centered perspective as opposed to an adult, this is what normal is, I want to get you there perspective.
Absolutely.
It sounds so basic, but it needs to happen more. And I think there needs to be that paradigm shift, you know, where it's happening on the ground in the schools and the doctor's offices. We have so much to talk about, and I know we're out of time, and I'm really sad about that. I wanted to talk about your whole concept of a disability of trust. You don't have time for that, do we?
It's kind of that's a long discussion.
It's a huge topic. Yeah. Okay, everybody has to go read the book. I'm so sorry. You do explain it very, very thoroughly in the book.
Yes.
So we are going to have to end, and I'm very sad about that. But I'm really excited that you gave me this time. I really feel so honored, and this has been so amazing. I just want you to end with, what is the most important thing that somebody should know, anybody should know, not even necessarily a parent, about how to help someone on the spectrum?
I think the most important thing, number one is the attitude, and that is every child, every person is an evolving human being. The next most important thing is we have to immerse a person in life, in things they love to do, in things we could help them feel competent. We have to focus on that positive sense of self and that self-esteem. It's so essential. And for people who have seen very few autistic kids and say, well, every autistic kid I see is just so challenged, how do you do that? I will tell you, I have known and currently know many autistic kids and people who find life to be joyful, who've learned how to deal with the challenges, but also know what they're good at, also love and trust people. And it's all about how we support kids on their journey as an evolving human being.
Absolutely. And I want to say one more thing. I really appreciate it. Let me go over a little bit. Sure. The concept of interdependence is something that you've also talked about. And I think that's really important, because I think for parents who are looking at their kids and they're getting older and they're not independent, that's terrifying.
Yes. And this is not just me. Also, some very good autistic friends talk about this as well. And that is, for years, people talk about independence almost being the promised land. Mm-hmm. And that could be for, you know, an 8-year-old child or a 40-year-old person, you know. And what we're embracing now is quality of life is heavily dependent upon relationships and interdependence, that we do much better when we know who we could trust, we know who we could rely on. Seek out that help. It doesn't mean you're bad or you're stupid if you need help with certain things. And unfortunately, one of the last things that I often see that's learned in young autistic kids, and even some adults, is learning how to ask for help and seeing that as a good thing, not seeing that as something that's terrible. So interdependence is a good thing. No human being is totally independent in their lives. Yeah, it's nice to be able to do things on your own without support, but it's as nice to know how to get that support from other people when you need it.
Right. And unfortunately, it's a big part of American culture to be independent.
Yes.
That's the ideal, but that's not the reality of human beings. And this isn't true just for people on the spectrum. It's true for all of us.
We autistic people would be better off and are better off when they live in communal cultures as opposed to individualistic societies and cultures. And you're absolutely right. Western U.S. especially is highly individualistic, as opposed to we should be taking care of each other in our communities.
Right, but that's a message for everybody. And I'm going to let you go, but I want to wish you a happy, healthy new year. And thank you so much for doing this with me. I appreciate it more than I can say.
Thank you, Alyssa. It's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You too.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOWMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.